welcome to Future Library. Unbelievably, 50th episode. Well, I say 50th, but technically it's the 51st because there was an episode number A. I can't remember which one. It was 36 or 37 A, which I guess I could get into a whole argument about whether this is the 51st or the 50th. I choose 50th, and that's what I'm sticking with. So, listeners, there may be some changes for the next one. I may even put a new theme tune on, because after 50 episodes, maybe that's the time to do it. I don't know. But my guest today, he is all the way from Dundee. Yes, I'm back in Dundee again this week. He sounds like he's skiing at the moment or something.
No, do you know what it is? It's actually, I'm sharing a room with my dog at the moment. And he's decided to change positions. He's a noisy bugger.
That's absolutely fine. We encourage this kind of thing on this podcast. I don't know if I said we, the royal we there. I should say I encourage this sort of thing on this podcast. So background noise is always good. Kieran, we're back in Dundee again because it is, listeners, such a rich seam of talent. Kieran, who is known as Kieran McNairn and Kieran McRobin, and Kieran does a lot of things, and rather than me, as traditional every single episode, rather than me telling you all about him, I can pretend that I know loads, but that I'm being really kind of generous and handing it over to my guest to explain about it. And it takes a lot of weight off me, you see, listeners. It's again, seeing behind the curtain here, it's a little podcasting trick where you say, oh, let my guest introduce himself. And then you can sit back and go, that's interesting, I should have done some research. So, Kieran, tell us a bit about yourself.
Okay, so, yeah, my name's Kieran, and my real name's Kieran McRobin. Performing-wise, kind of accidentally, I've been known as Kieran McRobin. We'll get into that in a second. I'm actually from Arbroath, which is just outside Dundee, mm-hmm. but I'm in Dundee most of the time, so we'll stick with Dundee, that's fine. Musically, I started off playing drums in a bunch of punk bands. Moved on to a little bit of, I guess you would just say death metal. Just playing drums as fast and as hard as you can, so that's fun. During that time, I was always writing lyrics, but I can't sing, especially in a punk band. I can't do anything like that, so most of my lyrics went to waste. And then a couple of years ago, I realised that people read lyrics out a cappella without anything at all. They just got on stage and read things, and they called it spoken word poetry. So,
yeah, it's the new thing, apparently.
Yeah,
sweeping.
I mean, I heard one of my influences, Kate Tempest, on Radio 6 the other day, sitting in work listening to spoken word whilst other folk are, you know, had their headphones on listening to whatever. It's quite a bizarre experience. It's listening to someone tell a story instead. So I started doing spoken word poetry a couple of years ago. I only started performing last year. Performing without being behind a big kit. It's quite intimidating, I guess, but it's been fun anyway.
It makes a difference, doesn't it? I have to say, I mean, I can absolutely understand where you're coming from with the going from doing something that makes a lot of noise with other people making a lot of noise to doing something that's very, very quiet.
Yeah, it's quite intimidating.
It is, yeah. I think people who haven't done it may not understand just how intimidating it is. Because when, and you'll, I know that you're gonna feel the pain of this, when you're playing in a loud band, you can just blast away, and it doesn't matter if the audience are making a noise.
Yeah.
But the second you're doing something either with an acoustic guitar or just standing on your own, suddenly the slightest noise is problematic. And can put you off, and it can be, yeah. So did you find that was going from that kind of having that wall of sound to having nothing was really peculiar?
Oh, it's very off-putting, especially because when I'm playing drums, I'm really, really focusing on the actual kit. I'm not looking around and performing for the crowd. I'm just playing the songs. I've got my drum face on and my tongue sticking out and I'm sweating. And, you know, that doesn't matter because I can only see the kit. But if I'm standing with a microphone and I'm reciting things. You know, I don't like to have my phone or a bit of paper or something. I prefer to all off the top of my head. I'm looking at the crowd, and if crowd's moving or pointing or people are going to the bar, even their movement's really, really off-putting. Not just the silence.
Mm-hmm. No, I know what you mean. It's kind of the people moving. I mean, even somebody getting up to go to the toilet can
be totally
really off-putting. And especially, I'm guessing, if you're doing kind of poetry. I mean, I was listening to some of your work earlier, and you kind of have a very kind of conversational way with it, and it kind of flows in a really nice way. And the rhymes are really kind of subtle when they're there, and they kind of, you don't even notice them until they've passed. You go, oh, there was a rhyme there. Because they just sort of drop in very naturally into the flow of the almost the kind of just somebody talking to you. And I can imagine that if you've got a way of performing it that you've got a kind of rhythm to it, having somebody kind of scrape a chair or do something odd out the corner of your eye can throw you.
Yeah, no, totally. The recordings that I've done so far, the initial ones I had on SoundCloud, I would read out my SoundCloud address, but I really, really cannot remember. I think it's SoundCloud. If you just search Kieran McRobin, you'll get them there. That's things that I've done on my phone. So that's really just practicing. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other recordings, which are on Bandcamp, which is kieranmcrobin.bandcamp.com, those were done with one of my friends who's studying sound production. So he done it as a way to, you know, get something for his portfolio. And it was at that point that I realized that I perform differently than I record, which is strange. So when I'm performing, like you say, it's quite conversational. So I really have to emphasize specific points in the different poems to make them stand out. Because like you say, if someone goes to the toilet and comes back, they've missed the rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it's disturbed my flow. So yeah, it's been quite a steep learning curve, to be honest with you.
So, I mean, because I noticed from looking at Facebook and things that you seem to be performing quite a lot. How did you find getting shows? I mean, one thing I should probably point out to listeners that probably advantageous is that the Dundee scene has always been quite supportive of different types of things being done and would always be quite happy for a combination of, you know, somebody doing folk music with a metal act, with a pop act, all on the same bill, and nobody would think it was weird. So has that played in your favour? I mean, I don't know if that's still the case up there.
Oh, no, that's totally is the case. And there's, I think, from the time you've left to the time now, sorry, from the time you moved away from Dundee to now, there's probably a whole new set of promoters, but they all do the exact same thing. I think it's just trying to cater to as many audiences as you can. So for me, getting gigs and things, it's usually just a case of messaging promoters saying, I do this, is there any chance I can come and open one of your shows? And I'm not asking for any money. I'm more than happy to turn up and provide some entertainment for free. So most people are usually quite happy to have me on, especially because it's not something that people have seen before. I don't know about yourself, but I've never really seen any spoken word acts in Dundee.
No, you're absolutely right. No, and I guess the other thing as well that makes it easy for promoters and people putting on gigs is you're an easy sound check.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's also kind of scary. I mean, for those that maybe don't know, if you're playing maybe like a local show where there's a couple of local bands and, you know, there's maybe 50 people or something, normally you'll have the headline act, so to speak, will sound check first. They'll get all the equipment sorted. Then everyone else gets 5 minutes to sort their stuff. So by the time it comes to me sound checking, I have to jump on stage, do a very quick mic check, then jump off, grab my water, and then jump back on to start.
It reminds me of when I used to do acoustic shows. The nice part of it is that you do get to the point where you're not having to sit going, you know, with the engineer going, bass drum, and then you sit there going, dum, dum, dum. And it slowly kind of sweeps through the EQ, so it starts going, dum, 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 through the PA. And then you kind of go, oh, then it's snare drum, then it's, dum, 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 and it's like, and then it goes, then it's, toms, and you're like, oh god, this funk it, you know.
And as a drummer, you're sitting there doing that as well.
Yeah.
And then halfway through your sound check, you have to stop the whole band and say, look, can I get a little bit more vocals in my monitor?
Yeah.
Because this one part of the song, I only listen to the vocals for my rhythm.
Yeah. So you've got all that you'd normally do. But then when you go to suddenly the exact opposite end of the performance spectrum, when you kind of virtually nothing but yourself, all you have to do is just go, hello? And if you can hear it a little bit through the PA and you know that it's working and you can hear yourself through the monitors, you're like, yeah, that's fine.
And
there's a certain joy to that, I have to say.
Oh, no, definitely, yeah. And what I normally do is I'll get up on stage and I'll ask the barman, can you hear me okay? Do I sound good? Yeah. Okay, brilliant. can I get a pint, please? I'll be off in a second.
See, that's what you need, isn't it? And I suppose also, I mean, have you played outside of the kind of Dundee area yet?
Not yet, no. I've been asked to do a couple, but I'll be honest, it's really, really intimidating going somewhere where there's a bunch of full bands, especially people I don't know. So I think that's the next step.
You see, that's the good thing, though. You're going to be the person who turns up at the venue in another town, who's able to just walk in without any gear, and they go, "So what are you using tonight?" Just me. It's just me. I don't have any PA with me. You know, maybe in a year or so you'll be like, I've brought my own mic, but that's it. You know? I've got this in your pocket.
Yeah.
But it makes it nice and straightforward. I mean, I liked playing acoustic shows because it was a case of, you know, you'd strum the guitar once into the mic pointed at that, and you'd go 1-2 into the mic, and you go, yeah, you go la la la, strum, strum, strum. Yeah, that's fine. And engineers, you'd be like, you don't want to do a song? No, it's fine.
Nah, I can hear myself. You can hear me. We're all good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I suppose you do have the risk, though, of the venues with the very muffled mics and all that kind of stuff. So, but they. Have you run into a lot of the kind of asteroid head, kind of Shure mics that have been at the venue for like 90 years and are giving you a shock when you touch them?
I've been lucky in that respect. I mean, previously, when I worked in punk bands and things, yeah, I had some venues that you play around Scotland. Their sound equipment's been there since the 70s. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's been quite a few of that, but none whilst I'm performing on my own. I've been quite lucky, actually. I think even in my first ever gig, I just turned up to an open mic night in it was like a metal pub in Dundee. So, the balcony bar was where people used to go for metal or alternative nights, yeah? There's a new one open called Cerberus. They'll do open mic nights once a week, and maybe someone will turn up and play some gothic metal on their keyboard. Someone else will turn up and just play some comedy songs or play covers or something. And then I showed up, and the mic was absolutely fine. It was perfect. But that's actually a good story, talking about being on stage and how intimidating it can be. This was my first show. I've never performed any of my poetry in front of anyone at all. I just decided that if I was going to do it, I might as well just do it, just start. So I showed up, I asked the guy if we could go on. He says, yeah, just after the song on you go. So I started to try and explain what I do. So I said to the crowd in the pub, I says, I'm going to do what some people call spoken word poetry. I'm basically just telling a story. Sometimes it's going to rhyme. I might swear. So some guy from the bar shouted, come on, just fucking get on with it. I said, right, okay, I'll start then. That was the first time I was heckled. Almost as soon as I open my mouth.
So you start talking and somebody's already shouting at you.
Yeah,
brilliant. But see, this is the thing. I mean, have you started to kind of develop the anti-heckler techniques yet?
Oh, so I've realised that it's actually incredibly easy to put someone down if they're heckling you, especially if they're in a crowd.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, I'm standing on stage on my own talking poetry. Like, how easy of a target could I be? Like, the easiest thing to do in that respect is to just point out what an incredibly masculine guy that is, showing at the poet on stage. Must have massive testicles to do that. And normally they shut up.
Well, it's one of the things that's quite nice about it is that you can tell a heckler, you can put them down, and you don't, if you don't want to, you don't have to get into a back and forth with them, because you can drop your little kind of anti-heckle bomb on them. And then you can just start talking about something else. And they lose their window of opportunity to try and re-engage you. And it kind of says to everybody, yeah, I'm in control. I'm the person with the mic. And, you know, I'm going to be calling the shots here. Talking about being the person with the mic, do you find that, I'm hoping the listeners are going to be interested in this, but it's something that interests me because it's something I know that I do when I have a mic that's live and I'm, you know, in front of people. Do you find that your mic technique is changing?
That was probably the most scary thing of all. Standing, talking to people is no problem at all. You just pretend that you're confident and then you get on with it. But holding a mic, talking into a mic, the way that you angle it, things like that. Even when you're recording, you've got your pop shield and you know you can move away and things. But yeah, I've had to learn mic technique. I didn't know anything about that at all. In fact, for my first three performances, I just left it on the stand. I just stood and showed it in our stand. So, yeah, my mic technique's definitely changing. And it's something that you don't think about at all.
It's one of the joys of doing it. Because, I mean, I've only done it once, but I used to do quite a lot of talking between show songs as well. But I've done one show that turned into just straight stand-up, and I didn't do any songs at all. And I just talked for the whole set. But during my acoustic shows, it used to be quite a lot of talking between the songs, and it was almost like a kind of stand-up thing with the occasional song dropped in. And you get used to the thing where you can, you know, you'll come back off the mic when you want to raise your voice a little bit, but then you can get right in and you kind of like, and then I was doing this and this, and you kind of learn how the, as long as it's coming through the PA okay, you kind of learn what works and you learn how quietly you can talk into the mic. I mean, one of the techniques I found that was quite good is, you know, if you start to quieten down, the audience will start to quieten down because they'll realise that things are quietening down. So if you start to get a little bit quieter and a bit closer to the mic and start saying, well, I'm here tonight to see what's going on, and they will kind of slowly hush down. I'm doing little hand movements, and I don't know why, because nobody can see them. So you kind of find these things out, and you know, if you've not yet got to that point, which I'm guessing you probably have, but if you haven't yet, that's still part of the big adventure of mic technique. Mic technique in its own right is a weirdly satisfying thing, I think.
Yeah, that's probably next on the list, the volume thing. Quite a few of my poems are about maybe being frustrated or angry, and trying to convey that using just words is kind of hopeless. It loses a bit of effect if you've got a microphone. So if you can control the volume properly, yeah, that's probably next on the list of things to learn, I would say.
Well, you could always look at the old Stuart Lee technique where you step right back from the microphone and even put it down and yell for a bit or go into the audience just start yelling. You know,
yeah.
He's a master of it.
Yeah, he really is. That's something that I've had to do, actually. If the microphone's misbehaving a little bit, I'll just step away and shout, because it's not like I'm playing stadiums.
No, exactly. And that's the other thing as well. They're not playing stadium things. Now, this, and again, it's just completely just flown in from the side, this. A lot of musicians and a lot of artists seem to think that success is measured by how big the places you play are. But I kind of think that success is measured by two things, of being able to do what you want to do and continue doing it. And, you know, and having, you know, known of you for quite some time now, Kieran, through going way back to the underground scene board. So it must be up about 10 years that I've kind of been, you know, that we've been in the same sort of scenes.
It probably is 04 or 05, you're right.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah, wow.
Having seen that, and you've kept doing what you've wanted to do, which is success. It's been something that I've talked about on the podcast before. But the other side of it as well is, part of it is working out what size venue you're actually happiest in. And I personally like smaller, more intimate venues. It's not one of these things of like, yeah, you know, I've failed to get to the point where I can play large venues, so I'm just making excuses. It's not that at all. I actually quite like the whole sense of, you know, maybe 100, 150 tops. And that, to me, would be a big place to play. I'd prefer, like, you know, 50, 60 people maximum. You know, down to 20, 15 can be okay. But, you know, 20 to 60 is a nice size in a smallish room.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with you there. So yeah, the first thing was the success thing. The second thing was being comfortable in your environment, I guess. So I think I totally agree. I've played a couple of bigger places around Scotland with bands, and a lot of smaller places with bands as well. And the smaller places are by far the best gigs.
Yeah,
it's just more fun. It's as if you're playing to people rather than a room.
Yes,
which is probably the difference. And especially with what I'm doing now, where I'm literally just speaking at people. You know, I'm not speaking to them. I'm speaking at them. And it's better if you're doing it to people and not a room. I've had it before where I've been speaking to quite a big hall. If you've got anyone listening from Dundee, the old On Air East, which has been renamed a couple of times, I performed in there. And if you've got 10, 20 people there, it still looks empty. So it's an old church.
Yeah.
So, you know, it feels really weird if there's no one there. I much prefer in a pub or a really small venue, a couple of people there. You know, 50 would probably be brilliant. 50 people is probably ideal.
Yeah.
Any more than that, and I might start to get intimidated.
And I think, you know, if we're going by Dundee scale,
yeah.
I think kind of 50 people in a venue like the size of Druthy Niebuhr's or the Art Bar or something like that,
yeah,
is a good size and quite good venues. I think the other thing I remember about On Air East, as was in whatever name it's, you're absolutely right, it has gone through about 50 name changes over the years. Didn't it become the Doghouse Part 2 for a little while or something?
That's right, yeah. It was the Doghouse for a little bit.
Yeah, then it's been all sorts of things, hasn't it? It's one successful business venture after another, that venue's been.
Yep.
A bit like...
It's been to the point where I've told people I'm performing it one name and I turn up and it's changed name by the time I get there.
And that's between you leaving the house and arriving at the venue for the show.
Sorry, Alex. Going back to the first point you had there, I thought that was a really interesting point. How an artist defines success. Because like you say, I've never been a big success as in sold loads of records or played to thousands of people. But it's exactly what you say. It's setting out to do something, achieving what you set out to do. The whole reason I started doing spoken word poetry and standing up and speaking to people and crowds and writing things and recording things, it was basically because I've never been a confident person. I thought one way to prove to myself that I can be more confident is to perform some of the things that I've been writing. And I had no idea if what I was writing was good or not. I really still don't. I just have to go on what other people say. And I think the definition of success for me at that point was getting in front of some people, reciting my poems, and then getting off again and not getting hit in the face. That's probably success. And so it's anything after that first performance is easy. It's completely successful now. There's no pressure at all. So it's really good.
Absolutely. I think that's the way it should be. And I mean, the thing is, you look at the guys that kind of have had levels of success and, you know, the bands that you'd see on the front of the NME, you know, 10 years ago. And then when they kind of turn up in a Where Are They Now feature, Q or Mojo, whatever, and all of them are just working day jobs and don't play any music at all and don't do anything, you know. So-and-so now works for, you know, this dog rescue place, and this person works for a bike shop, and this person, you know, despite having tried to get success, he had a string of unsuccessful bands afterwards and committed suicide. You know, it's all this kind of stuff. And you think, well, those guys had this minimum level of success where they earned less than the minimum wage during that period, made less money than most normal people make from just a day job, and only did it for 5 years. Whereas,
well,
if you don't have that kind of meteoric rise, if you kind of have this kind of, if you're able to be comfortable at the level you find yourself at, then you keep doing it, and you can keep doing it, and I mean, I can't imagine that you're going to be not doing it in 20 years' time. Whereas the more kind of ambition type people may not be, you know, they may be working in banks or, you know, doing whatever, or as it seems these days, all working as managers in call centres, and, you know, and having and saying, "Oh yeah, I used to play. Yeah, I was in a band in my 20s." It's like,
yeah, not everyone's got a theoretical physics PhD to fall back on, do they?
That's it.
Like, you know, being in D-Ream and
'90s. Exactly, yeah, you can't, you know, bash away at the keyboard and then go on television and be like, I love stars, they're fucking AIDS. Oh, look at all those stars. It's like somebody's got a black sheet and put holes in it. Ooh. Yeah, we can't all do that.
That sounds exactly like him as well.
I am quite proud of my Brian Cox, so I appreciate the opportunity to be able to do it, because it doesn't come up very often. You were saying about record sales, though, because you've got the... it's difficult to describe it as an EP, really. It's more of a... I don't know, how would you describe... How do you describe a release of spoken word?
Yeah, I have no idea. I was stuck with that as well. I have no idea what to call it. I called it an EP because I guess I don't know what else to call it. It's not exactly a single, is it?
Collection.
Yeah. That was one of my other targets. So the first target was literally just to perform, just to get out there and show people my things. that's what I've been doing on the streets for a while. But
you've been going out there, showing people your things. You've avoided arrest so far. So you thought, you know what? I'm going to rub it in the face of Tayside police. I'm just going to take it to the stage, see what happens.
Yeah, just swing it about, see what happens.
So you get out there with you. So obviously we should clarify to any listeners who haven't picked up here, we're not talking about his genitals.
Yeah, not yet. Talking about my poems.
Yes.
So yeah, my first target was just to perform my poems in front of people. The second one was to release some sort of collection. So I got together with some of my friends and we put together 5 tracks. The time was really cut short, actually. I'd said before he was learning sound production. He's been learning it in his bedroom, as I guess most young people would do if they're teaching themselves something. Mm-hmm. As soon as we got 3 tracks in, his parents came home and started making a hell of a noise. And if you've got any sort of microphone, it's going to pick up everything. So we had to cut it short. I was intending to release 10 tracks, 10 or 11, but we kind of had to cut it short. And he's one of these... one of these nomadic people who are going to start off in Dundee, travel across to France and live there for a few months, travel to Switzerland and live there for a few months, and then he might come back here in September, or he might not come back at all. I've no idea. So we've kind of arranged, when he does come back to Arbroath, that we're going to sit down and record the rest of my poems that I've got finalised now. So I don't know what you would call it. I guess E is probably the closest you're going to get to a description.
Yeah, I guess certainly if you're coming from a musician's background, I think an EP would be the appropriate thing. I wonder what actually, you know, people who haven't come from a musician's background who do spoken word call it. A compendium, a compilation, a collection.
Collection's probably right.
Collection would be quite good.
A collection of short poems. There you go.
And you also have them up on your blog.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I write quite a lot. Most of it doesn't get put anywhere. Some of it's good enough to be read, and some of it's, you know, appropriate for reading. And then there's other things that maybe aren't, and they look good structurally. My blog is waxingsimulacra.blogspot.com. And I put up anything that I write there, whether it's a short story or... articles of things I've been thinking about or my poems. There's a couple of really interesting examples there of things that I like to write just for the structure. Some of my spoken word poems are quite short, but they look longer when I'm writing them down, so it feels like I should be able to perform them. So I think some of the stuff that I've put on the collection, the audio collection, maybe 30 or 40 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some of the other stuff that I've written on my blog, it's maybe 5 or 6 lines. So it's going to be 10 seconds if you read it. But the reason I publish those things is because it's really interesting to see what people think about playing with words and structures and things like that. There's one particular one I'm on there I'm quite proud of, which is about Facebook and how they manipulate the use of the word friend. It's kind of a little bit insidious, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You want to take your friend's recommendations when there's an advert pops up, and you don't want to remove your friend and make your network smaller. So it's interesting.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that you bring that up, that there's certain poems that you think work well almost in the kind of way the words sit visually with each other, and others that work well spoken. Because I think there's an art to that. I think it's something that bands don't get when they name themselves. That there's, you know, with a band name, it has to sound good and look good written down. And I think a lot of bands forget that. So they come up with a band name that they think sounds good, but then it gets written down and it just looks like dog shit.
Like a great example is the Polyphonic Spree. That rolls off the tongue. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
And then you compare that to Clean Bandit, which looks and sounds ridiculous. So, yeah, you're probably right.
And also you have to take into account for bands, and this is a top tip for bands, how easy is it to Google? I think, like the band Pavement, no one's finding that.
But that's a good point.
The band Sebado, everything is going to come up.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That works for businesses and companies as well. I work in project management day-to-day for web development, and one client that I have asked us why they couldn't be found easily. They said, look, we're getting a lot of search traffic, but not a lot of people are clicking through our pages. And one of the reasons is because they had their company name shared the exact same movie title as a movie which is in the top 10 of the IMDb ratings. So literally one of the most popular movies that has ever been made, that's their company name. So, yeah.
But you see, that's a little game now for the listeners that, you know, we won't mention the name of this company, but, you know, go along to IMDb and see if you can work out which one it is.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
See, I don't know. I'm going to go and look later on. I'm going to look at it and think, which would work as a movie title? As a business title?
I'll give you a clue. It's not Gladiator.
I'm guessing it's probably not Star Wars.
No, it's A New Hope. Selling beds. No, it's not.
So, but I mean, I got kind of slightly distracted then. So, yeah, because I did have a point that I was going round to. The collection / EP / compendium, whatever. You put it up on Bandcamp, which is, I ought to get them to sponsor the show the amount of times I mention it, because I'm a big fan of Bandcamp. So how did that do on Bandcamp? Do you find that people stream it and don't buy it, or have people been quite supportive and bought it?
The statistics on Bandcamp are really interesting. This is the first time I've ever used the website, so I didn't know what to expect. The performance of my collection of poems was incredibly surprising. It's sort of tailed off now, but for the first month or so, it garnered about 300 listens in total, which was incredible for me because I don't think I even know that many people. So I just expected five or six. So 300 plays in the month was amazing. And the one thing that I did, maybe I shouldn't have, but I put £1 on it. So you could download all the tracks for £1. If anyone told me they were going to buy it, I would gladly just send them the tracks for free. I just wanted to see who would click on the buy, just as an experiment. And a couple of people did actually buy it, which was surprising. There was people that paid money and didn't even download it. So on Bandcamp, you can see a number paid, number downloaded, and then the total that you've earned from each release or track. There was some people actually paid for it and didn't download it. I don't know why.
Well, I think I can probably explain why with that. And I don't know whether... Because what's happened recently with the Bandcamp app on Android and iOS, if you pay for a release, even if it's one that's, you know, pay whatever you like or whatever, if you pay for it, then it turns up in your collection on the app. And then you can play it through the app and stream it.
That may be what it is.
Yeah, so I've downloaded a lot of stuff from Bandcamp over the years, and most of it has been stuff where it's, you know, pay what you want and you just type zero in and download it. But even if you put a penny in, it pops up. I believe if you put a penny in, you can maybe it has to have a minimum, but I think it's even whatever you pay. I'm just opening the app now. You put it in and the ones that you've paid for will come up as being listenable. So it gets to the point where you could probably kind of build a record collection just downloading things off Bandcamp or paying for them on Bandcamp, never downloading them. Because you can always go back and download them at a later date. There's nothing to stop you, but it sits there as something that you can listen to through the app. And I think I kind of wonder if that's maybe how people are going to do things in future. It seems that streaming's quite a big thing, and I think Bandcamp doing that is quite a clever way of kind of cornering a little bit of the market of streaming.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, it certainly explains my statistics, but that's totally true, because that's probably how I listen to music as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go. So performance-wise, how things have went, it's been outstandingly positive, and I did not expect it whatsoever.
And see, that's good, isn't it? You've gone into it with kind of experimenting to see what would happen, not had any kind of major expectations, and have been pleasantly surprised by it. And I think platforms like Bandcamp, and again, it's something I've said tons of times on the podcast, it's great for the artists, because the amount of money you get back if somebody buys something is far greater than the amount of money you'd get from anywhere else. And if somebody wants to stream it, they have to buy it, and you get pretty much 100% of what they spend. It's quite a good model, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting here nodding my head. Nobody can see that. I totally agree with you. Yeah. The only downside is your payment gateways. So with Bandcamp, you're kind of tied to PayPal, aren't you? Mm-hmm. PayPal take a fair chunk off for processing fees and things.
And the other thing that's quite surprising, well, I mean, they're not as bad as they could be, though. I mean, and it seems me that recently, when I've been getting things bought by people, so I've been getting the money through Bandcamp, that I seem to get pretty much the whole whack, apart from like just a couple of pence. But the thing that's kind of, because I think you have to set up to be able to take micropayments or something with PayPal for Bandcamp.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
But the thing that's kind of slightly nerve-wracking with Bandcamp, it's slightly irritating when it happens, is that when you're kind of at the low level and you've not shifted up to a certain amount of money's worth of stuff, they don't take their fee from each release. So because Bandcamp take a small amount, you know, there's a small percentage they take, but they don't take it off each release. They wait until you've built up to a certain amount. Then somebody buys it, and you think, it goes, you've got a sale, and you go, yay! And then it goes, all of this goes in fees, and you go, so you're going to go, you know, somebody pays £10 for something, and you go, yay, £10. And it goes, this will go towards your balance that you owe Bandcamp. You're like, no.
Yep. I've had the exact same experience with Fiverr.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that I've been doing is freelance writing.
Yes, I was going to ask about that, which you very neatly brought me to that. Excellent.
It's a nice seg.
Yeah.
So with Fiverr, someone paid for a gig there. I wrote them an article, sent it away on time. They paid. I checked my account and I had $4. I thought, what's going on there? So I had a look at the breakdown of the miniature invoice you get, and it turns out they take a dollar off every five that you earn. So you're not really getting $5.
Typical Fiverr.
Yeah, it should be. I mean, I'm not taking it out. It's just sitting there. That was an experiment. So I can't even pay for another Fiverr gig without putting a dollar in there. Yeah, it's useless.
It's quite sneaky of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, I suppose it's something like PayPal. The way they're working it now is that I think PayPal is starting to see themselves as being... they're starting to treat themselves a little bit more like a bank, and being a kind of a one-stop thing for a lot of trade and online commerce. So, you know, before it used to be you put money in, you bought something, and they put money back in, you took that money out and put it in your bank account. And now I will often just leave money in PayPal, because I know that at some point I'm going to buy something that requires PayPal.
Yeah,
so
totally.
I'll buy it. And they've now started doing this thing, this PayPal at home, where you could order kind of like a card reader for like a shop. And so if somebody had a PayPal credit card or debit card or whatever it is, you can get this card that kind of connects to PayPal. If they brought that into your shop, and you could feed it into PayPal. And I don't know if maybe it works with other credit cards, so people could pay for things with their plastic straight into your PayPal account through this little handset.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's starting to kind of take on the role of a bank almost.
It's interesting for small merchants, I guess. If I don't know what PayPal's rates are like. If they've got good rates, then it might be worth it for someone. But I don't know.
They're good for some things. I mean, My wife's American, and we found that sending money to the States for things was good up to a certain point with PayPal, after which their fees suddenly become slightly more than the bank. But it's a balancing act. You're going to have to work out what's the best way to do it with the amount of money you're wanting to send or receive, I guess. So, you know, but I think it's kind of interesting. Again, it's putting the power that big corporations had, and I'm not denying that PayPal are a big corporation, and Bandcamp are no doubt, you know, quite profitable for the people who run Bandcamp, but they're putting a lot of power into the hands of the small merchant or the small artist, and I think that's a really positive thing. It's kind of cutting out the middlemen completely. You don't need a record label. You don't need, you know, to deal with money transfer rates. You don't have to go to a bureau de change to get your money changed to send it off to the States. You just, it will do it all within the software now.
Yeah, so it's brilliant. Especially for, like you're saying, for artists and independent artists and things like that, but as well for small businesses. If you want to start a business, you set up a PayPal account, you put a buy now button on your website, and you're there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's so easy.
Brilliant.
So the other thing you were saying is you do this writing, and you write about... Well, you tell me about it. You write about wrestling. Is that right?
No. Oh, my God.
Not wrestling.
It's, I have been writing about mixed martial arts for a while, which some listeners might know derogatorily as cage fighting.
Oh, there we go. That shows that my brain wasn't picking it up properly. Yeah. And the thing is, I kind of knew that, and I don't know why I said wrestling. Because I had a mental image of like, you know, Hulk Hogan for a second. And the word wrestling came out. And that's not what it is at all. It is, it's more, yeah, it's actual proper sports you write about, isn't it?
Right, yeah. So I've been writing about that sort of on the off chance. I started maybe 4 years ago. I've been following the sport for a while. So the main league, as it were, was UFC. Who are absolutely massive now. Their athletes are getting sponsored by Nike, Adidas, Gatorade, you know, huge sponsors. Mm-hmm. I started following that maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and completely on the off chance, I thought, I like writing. I really like this website. They've got kind of a irreverent humour sort of thing going on. They say that they cater for the proto culture, MiddleEasy.com. So I started writing with Middle Easy on the off chance. I wrote an article which I thought would be funny and they would appreciate the humour. And I was taking the style of their writing and adapting it. The editor came back and says, look, we really like it. It's on the site. Do you want a job? So completely on the off chance. So I've been writing about mixed martial arts with Middle Easy for a while. I'm on a little bit of a hiatus just now. The site changed last year to take on... a number of different topics. Mm-hmm. So one of the main reasons for that is, along with any fringe sport, the crowd's going to come and go, and the money along with it, corporate-wise, is going to come and go. So the site, money-wise, it wasn't paying for itself. So we've expanded a little bit, so we're talking about other things. So if we're writing an article about mixed martial arts and we're talking about a fighter in particular, we'll normally just write about something completely unrelated but to do with our target audience. So... I might talk about UFOs, for example. Yeah. Talk about UFOs, maybe talk about aliens, and then seg into one guy's incredibly bizarre fighting style, and then do the story about him, or something like that.
Nice.
So we'll use the interests of the readers, who basically the sort of guys who would stay up till 6 or 7 in the morning watching fighting from Japan. That's the sort of hardcore audience we're dealing with. So we've changed from just writing about fighting to writing about anything that we think the audience is going to appreciate. So it's really let me open up and write about things like science. So, I mean, there's some science headlines you just go, that's awesome. That's really awesome. For example, the Google taking on the DARPA challenge, Google buying robotics companies and taking on the DARPA challenge, which is a... sort of like a robotics Olympics, where autonomous robots have to go through courses and navigate upstairs and go through windows and rescue situations and uneven territory and things. And writing about things like that is amazing.
Well, I think the other thing that's kind of interesting, it's interesting that you mentioned Google, because they've taken on is it Ray Kurzweil, the guy who wrote The Singularity Is Near, who's the kind of the prime guy for being desperate for the singularity, the technological singularity to occur. And he's in, I think he's head of production, product management or something at Google now. So they've got this guy who firmly believes that we'll be able to upload conscious human minds within, well, he says kind of technological immortality by 2045. So that's like, what, 30 years' time? He thinks that that's going to happen within 30 years. And he's in a position with arguably the most powerful tech company in the world.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Who could do it? They're the people. If anybody could do it and make it happen, it's going to be Google. And I think it's really interesting that that kind of stuff's going on. But I think it also segues again very nicely into the topics of your poems.
Yeah,
because totally. Listening back, I mean, your poems, they seem to me to be very, very personal. It seems from what I was listening to of the collection, they are quite kind of heart on sleeve. Yeah, that's the right phrase, isn't it? As I was starting to say it, I started to think, that sounds weird. Heart on your sleeve?
No,
what
the
hell? But that is the right phrase. But you also talk about, you know, how what was once seen as being geeky and was bullied for being geeky is now seen as cool.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and it ties in with those guys who stay up until the early hours of the morning to watch Japanese fighting, who will now be seen as like, you know, if somebody goes into work, they go, oh, you're a bit tired. Yeah, I stayed up until 6 o'clock watching Japanese fighting. Their colleagues will go, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
20 totally. Years ago, they'd go, oh, idiot, and flush their head down the toilet.
Well, who do you think 20 years ago would have been picked on for watching the Apple conferences? It's definitely the guys that are leading the field now, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the same thing.
Well, I think what has happened is that the geeks have, because of the rise of technology and because of really high-tech stuff becoming very much kind of consumer products and people just getting used to it, those guys have become the kind of, they've grown up to be the people who are then running the companies that are effectively running the world. So the geeks kind of won in a weird way.
Well, yeah, the geeks are definitely winning.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when it gets to the point where my mum, who's in her late 60s, she just runs pretty much all open source stuff on her computer.
Wow.
And thinks that it's totally normal. She's like, well, you know, why would I not do that? This stuff works. It gets updated regularly. Why wouldn't I?
No, you're probably right. I think my mum runs Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So, probably right. Yeah.
So these things that were seen as hardcore geek things a long time ago are now seen as being, you know, have become so mainstream that, you know, people are running Android, which I, you know, it was a geek operating system when it first came in. And all these things are, you know, I think it's really interesting that that has happened. And I thought it was quite nice listening to your poetry that you could have touched on that.
It's, it's something, I guess, that's close to my heart. I mean, I was born in 86, so I'm 28 years old. The Transformers movie, the cartoon, was released in 1986.
Yeah.
And my earliest memory is watching that on videotape until it broke. I've loved Transformers since I was four, I guess. Four. That's probably the earliest memory I've got, watching Transformers and G.I. Joe. And now you've got the Michael Bay abomination making millions and millions of pounds. And the movies don't make sense. It's not the Transformers I know, but the people that would have picked on me for watching the Transformers cartoon movie go to the cinema and they're quite happy to do it because it's got Megan Fox in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the subject matters like that are really quite close to my heart. Mm-hmm. So that poem, especially that, the poem's called A Poem About People I Hate. Which the alternative title is a poem about things I hate about people, I guess, because that's really just what happens, isn't it? It's I can't remember the right sociological term. It's basically like gentrification for entertainment, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just gets adopted and normalized.
It becomes seen as socially acceptable, doesn't it? Things that were seen as being, you know, avoid him, he's the guy who wears a Mac and carries a plastic bag and goes to Dungeons and Dragons. Suddenly that slowly seeps into mainstream culture and then isn't weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's Arbroath is probably as backwards as you're going to get in terms of towns. And we've got a shop here that sells video games and Magic the Gathering cards. And you're going to get 20, 30 teenagers in there playing Magic the Gathering in the evenings. That sort of thing was relegated to back rooms that looked seedy, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And to give listeners an idea of context here, if you're unfamiliar with Arbroath, it's one of the places that regularly turns up on things like Cops in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going, meanwhile, in Arbroath, Officer Smith is in a fight outside a bar.
Yeah. And it's I think there was one or two pubs were on Britain's Hardest Pubs.
Yes.
From Arbroath as well.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Were they flat roof pubs?
Yeah, the sort of place where you throw sawdust at the start of the night sort of thing.
Yeah, where they have a single strip light down the middle of the room. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. Yeah. A pool table with one pool cue because the other one's broken.
Yes. Yeah. So it's this odd combination, isn't it, that there's that, whilst there's still that kind of rougher element in a lot of towns in the UK, the people going along to places to play card games and to, you know, to watch videos about robots that turn into cars and, you know, who are excited about Doctor Who. And, you know, like 10 years ago, if you said you're excited about Doctor Who, people would look at you like you were some kind of arse. And you know, now even your mum's saying, oh, I can't wait to see Peter Capaldi as Doctor Who. You know, it's. I think there's this genuine sense of excitement about things. I think people have got. I think sci-fi and stuff and fantasy and things like that has become very much kind of absorbed into mainstream culture and has become something that people aren't ashamed to say they enjoy.
Which is on one hand, it's a breath of fresh air. Because I can tell people about my Warhammer armies. I can tell them I've been collecting dwarfs and goblins and things. But on the other hand, I guess it's kind of frustrating. And it's that type of elitist attitude of people can sort of catch up with your conversations because they've been reading Wikipedia for the last 30 years of Doctor Who, for example. And if you've been tuning in every week watching Doctor Who, you feel a little bit more invested, and it feels a bit insulting.
Yes.
That was kind of half of that poem. That one of the feelings behind that. The other one is, the indignation of, you know, these people are enjoying the things that I would have enjoyed when they were picking on me. It's kind of indignation that way. And the other part of it is one of the topics and themes that comes up regularly in the things that I write, sort of accidentally, is the topic of autonomy. So in that poem, a poem about people I hate, I'm talking about things that I enjoy and despising sort of people that have jumped the wagon. But it's mostly about me choosing to do those things regardless, you know, regardless of what other people think. I'm still going to like the original Transformers movie. Mm-hmm. That's my rainy day movie, you know?
Yeah.
I'll always watch that. I'm always going to play Pokemon. You know, I'll buy every Pokemon release that comes out because that's who I am. That's one of the topics that comes up in a lot of my poems, sort of self-direction and autonomy and choosing the way that you live your life.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, it's also becoming more acceptable anyway in terms of the... I was talking to Kat, my wife, about this, and we don't have ornaments around the house. We have, you know, an R2-D2 and various... we've got a couple of... what's he called? He's the Japanese guy who chased the kittens in that picture. Dumokon. Yeah, we've got a couple of those.
Yeah.
So we have these kind of things on our shelves instead of ornaments. So there's this whole generation that's growing up where we're going, yeah, it's fine. I can have a Millennium Falcon sitting on the fireplace. That's all right.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my workstation. We've got quite an open plan office, but there's an area which is mine. It's always going to be mine. And I've got my toys sitting there. I've got a Lego space station there. I've got a couple of guys from Dragon Ball Z sitting there. You know, so, yeah, it definitely is becoming more accepted.
Yeah, and it's, I kind of wonder if, I don't know, I'm not quite sure where I'm going with that. I kind of wonder if how how the, I wonder if those ornament things were the things that, you know, the older generations kind of saw. I don't know. I can't actually imagine a world where I'd want to buy a ceramic drummer boy or, you know, some high gloss birds or something.
Oh, yeah.
I guess maybe there's that thing of wanting to display things, but we're quite happy to go, yeah, there's these things from our childhood that we're not ashamed of. But on the other hand, I do like your point about that kind of sense of indignation that somebody who's just spent, you know, an afternoon on Wikipedia could be as caught up about all the kind of little Doctor Who novels and all the stuff from when it wasn't on telly and know that Paul McGann's Doctor was the Doctor a lot in a lot of episodes and novels and things, and you're going to go, oh man, and they know all about Big Finish Audio and all this kind of stuff, and they know all about the really obscure things, and you go, and part, I mean, I've got a friend who's really into Doctor Who, and he read all the novels and all this kind of stuff while that was going on, and has all these Big Finish CDs, and I can imagine him kind of going, oh, how they've not put the time in. But at the same time, in a way, it's kind of wonderful that people don't have to, that they can just get that information.
Oh, no, yeah, totally. One of the things that you have when you're part of a really small niche is that you have no one to talk to about things like this. Like, if I'm talking about sci-fi, for example, you know, if I'm reading sci-fi and I've just read, like I say in my poem, if I've been reading Asimov's I, Robot, which is a collection of short stories, and I want to say to someone, man, that the movie missed out so much, like, it wasn't even related to the story at all. It just took the name. Mm-hmm. That's really disappointing. And I want to talk about someone to that. I can't. But I guess now I can, because you can put that on your Kindle and fire through them whilst you're on the train in the morning. Yeah. So I guess it's good in a way.
We live in a world now where you can say to a work colleague, yeah, well, you know, I Am Legend, when they remade it, they completely ruined the point of it by changing it, and they missed the point of the title, making the title meaningless. And they're going, oh, why was that? And you go, have a quick look on Wikipedia. And they go back and they go, oh, so he was actually the baddie in the book. And it turned out that he was murdering these people and that he was seen as the monster.
Yeah.
You know,
which is why the second one apparently makes no sense. Apparently they're making a second I Am Legend.
Really?
Yeah, I think I've seen that somewhere.
I Am Legend 2.
Yeah, I Am Legend 2.
I Am Still Legend.
He's dead, because that's what happens.
I Am Legend again.
Yeah, I Am Still Legend.
That's the one. I Am Still bizarre. Legend is the name. And if it isn't called I Am Still Legend, then... And he's changed his name to Legend, then. John Legend.
I Am Still John Legend. Yeah. They need to sort themselves out. Yeah. To end on a good note, I was very, very pleased with the amount of people that were disappointed with Total Recall, with Colin Farrell in it.
Yeah.
Total Recall, the original, is one of my favourites. I mean, that's based on a short story by Philip K. Dick.
Yeah,
it's one of my favourite authors.
Yeah.
I think it's We Can Remember It for You Wholesale, maybe.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So it's one of my favourite authors. And I really wish I had the courage to do as much acid as he did. he was on a lot of psychoactive drugs. But the movie, I love the movie because it's just pure 80s.
Yeah.
Based on a book from one of my favourite authors. And the recent release, so many people have said it was so crap because they've torrented the original.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, brilliant. I'd love to hear more things get slated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is as well that on the other side of it though is that people are actually starting to do quite good versions of Philip K. Dick stories. There's quite a good version on Radio 4 over the last two weekends of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
No way.
Yeah, it's. I'll send you the file strip. And if you're listening from Radio 4, no, I won't. But I will. But again, BBC, I won't, because I don't have them. But I do have them, Kieran. But I don't have them, BBC. But yeah, I'll send you those files that don't exist of that. It was
if
really good.
If you had anything that could point me in that direction surreptitiously, that would be beautiful.
Yes. Well, I'm sure a Dropbox link of something that may kind of help will drop your way. But that's the thing. The BBC have always been really good, certainly with radio, they've always been very, very good at doing sci-fi. I mean, I went back and listened to the 70s version of the Foundation series, and it sounds really fucking weird because it's recorded in the early 70s, but because it's recorded in the early 70s, it sounds really alien as well, which is then very appropriate for the subject matter.
Yeah, totally.
So it's great. So on that bombshell, we should probably draw things to a close. So I will put links as to where people should go to find your stuff, Karen. So what's coming up next for you?
I've actually got nothing planned at all. The idea was, one of the things we didn't touch on at all, I know we're just closing here, was a lot of my subject matter comes from mental illness. And I was recently diagnosed with having type 2 bipolar. So my workflow kind of comes and goes with my moods like that.
Right.
So I'm doing nothing just now because I'm really happy.
I see.
So when I'm feeling down, I'll start writing again and then start performing. So it's kind of unpredictable that way.
So do you find that with the peaks and troughs of it, that there's a kind of write when you're in a trough and then come out of it and then perform what you wrote when you're coming up on the peak?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So yeah. I feel like I'm getting back into a writing phase now.
Yeah.
So I've started writing bits and pieces. So I think I'll write some more new things and start performing in a couple of months. And then maybe record more. We'll see what happens.
Do a live album.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic, yeah. Good idea.
Do live at a place. That's how the stand-up comedians do it. They don't go into a studio and record. They just set up the gear at the venue and record it that way.
Yeah, so maybe the next time I speak to you, we'll have some terrible banter recorded.
Excellent.
Live on stage.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say, I mean, you've touched on the mental health issues. At some point in the future, I do intend to do a show that's about people who are creative who have issues with mental health. I mean, I've made no secret of the fact that I've suffered from quite severe depression for years and years and years, and I know several other people who are in the same situation. I mean, you look at somebody like the comedian Limmy, who has been very open about his depression on Twitter. And I think it's kind of interesting to maybe speak to people about how that affects their creative process. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned that. So, yeah, listeners, that's something to listen out to. And definitely, Kieran, when I get that arranged, you'll be the first person I come knocking on the door of to get you on. And we'll have a full show about that kind of thing. So listeners, go and download Kieran's poems. Pay a small amount, then you can stream it to your iDevice and he'll get some money, and that's good. And support people doing different things, because it's important for people to do different things. It's not all about bands standing up on stage and bashing out four chords and wanting to be, you know, like, I don't know what the bands want to be like is now. So
I have no idea. Definitely. One of the most important things that has happened to me whilst I've been doing my spoken word is people listening and properly listening to the words and coming up afterwards and saying, man, I really agreed with some of that. We should talk soon. That's brilliant. That's the best feedback I think any small artist could get.
Yes, absolutely. You're engaging.
Really relate to your subject matter, yeah.
Yeah, you're engaging your audience and you're getting your audience want to have a conversation with you.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
You build a web of good people that way.
Yeah, totally.
That's how it works. So thank you ever so much for coming along. I think I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you.
I've enjoyed it as well, Alex. Thanks for reaching out. It's been brilliant.
I shall put, if you're okay for me to do it, I will put the poem we were discussing after we finish on the recording so that people can hear it. Because I toyed with the idea of saying, do us a poem now. But I think that's kind of awkward. When people say things like that to me, do us a song. I'm like, No, I'm not a performing monkey. I won't do it now. And it's all for being put on the spot. So I think it's probably better to play in a pre-recorded piece. So all that's left, I guess, now is for the 50th episode's Future Library. Goodbye. Goodbye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All my life I've been called a nerd, a loser, a geek. Just because I love to learn. I want to know why our calendar has 7 days in the week, and why we're so averse to sharing how much we earn. Thank God or Zeus or even the Big Bang for Wikipedia, because without it, I'd never be able to bore workmates with facts and interesting tidbits about who really controls the world's media. And it's not a conspiracy, by the way. Noam Chomsky told me, and his name holds weight in debate. It's just fate that this curse placed upon my tiny little head is now plastered across all these fucking t-shirts on little girls' chests, because being a geek is somehow cool now. Like I didn't get my head shoved in a fucking bin and my childhood is just one big fat cash cow. Like I wasn't so scared of ridicule for joining the debate club that I ran away and ate lunch on the pavement on my own. Wow. That's been a secret for so long. Where was I? Oh yeah. Tell me about your adventures in the Warhammer universe, fellow geek. Tell me about the time you spent reading short stories by Philip K. Dick and Bradbury for an entire week. How disappointed were you that the overarching story in Asimov's I, Robot was completely disregarded for the Will Smith adaptation? Who pushed you down the stairs in school because you thought superheroes were cool? Were you the last in your group of friends to pull? Yeah, teenagers can be cruel, but I'm still being ridiculed by the same people who went to see the Avengers 4 fucking times because Chris Hemsworth or Robert Downey Jr. makes them drool. Dungeons and Dragons is nothing like playing with a Barbie doll, and you sound like a fool for making that comparison, but I try to take it on the chin. Because I'd never expect anyone to understand why I run Linux instead of Windows on my netbook, or why I continually fix my 9-year-old iPod instead of buying a new one. And I'd never understand why you would mute the news, or think it's boring to see a meteor caught on camera crashing down to Earth with an impact like a giant cosmic gun. That's the reason I'll never buy a t-shirt that states in a very large font that everyone can read, I'm a domesticated animal on a very short lead.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening. Thank you.